a lot of the studies that I read for the book were about the interplay of women and anger. And it all said that because we don't tend to have like that little steam valve that lets out like a little bit every day, we tend to like wait until the lid blows off and then blow up.
Yeah.
Usually something, not the thing we're actually upset about. But you've had that catharsis of having a shouting fit, or you've stormed out of the house. And as soon as you have that catharsis, you then feel guilty and like you've got it wrong. Because I suppose technically you have got it wrong, but you've been pushed to that point.
Welcome to Women Are Mad, where we invite women to bring their anger into everyday conversation. I'm Salima Saxton, I'm an actress and writer.
I'm Jennifer Cox, and I'm a psychotherapist. We noticed that anger is the one emotion that women aren't allowed to openly express. Meanwhile, everything around us is making us absolutely furious.
We're all feeling it. Let's get together to work out what to do with it.
So, Salima, what's made you angry this week?
When I told you something that made me sound about six, did it make me angry? It made me shameful, and I'm angry at myself about this.
Right. Yeah. Do you want to tell our dear listeners what you did?
Yeah, so I've just started eavesdropping on my husband's phone calls sometimes, particularly when it's about work. I want to know what he's doing. And I found myself listening at the door of the study to see what was happening. And then I heard something, totally took it out of context, and it was completely wrong and everything was totally
fag end lil.
What's fag end lil?
I don't know, really know, but I think that's what it means.
I like that you throw these phrases out and you're like, but I don't know what they mean. Anyway, it sounds good. Yeah, so fag end lil. Yeah, the fag ends of a conversation, right?
Yeah.
And look, this is learnt behaviour of mine from my childhood, where I listened at doors in a hypervigilant way to check the temperature of rooms. And I don't mean Celsius.
No. Do you think, because I think this whole point about hypervigilance is really interesting, because of course it's designed in an evolutionary way to protect us. And it's like a safety behavior, isn't it? You'd think, oh yeah, that's sensible. Let me read the room. Let me work out what maybe I need to do to moderate the behaviors of other people as I go into it. I mean, it's all shocking, even as I'm saying it. It's awful. Of course it's never going to work or be of real use.
Yeah, but I it's definitely something that I did so much of as a child. And as a child, I just thought that was a really useful way of controlling the dynamics in my family.
It's so sad, isn't it?
It's so sad, yeah. And so when I'm feeling wobbly myself, you know, January and kind of wondering about, you know, and then I'm so sorry, I won't keep mentioning the fact that my dad died in November, but you know, he died in November. Yeah. So I think when I'm feeling a bit wobbly, I go to these old patterns of childhood. One of them is kind of half listening to try and ascertain what's going on. It's just really
And
also, can I just say what you text back to me, which was brilliant? You text back, this behavior has no place in your adult life.
I'm very strict.
I was like, okay. Okay, back away from the door, Salima. So thank you for that. Because I was like, I think you even wrote it in capitals.
Yeah, that's my pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. And now I'm going to introduce our guest for today. Our guest today is a journalist and author. Her revolutionary book, The Power of Rude, is a Bible for anyone attempting to challenge their freeze reflex. Going head-to-head on live TV with the likes of Piers Morgan shows her capacity to put her money where her mouth is. Please welcome the courageous Rebecca Reed.
Let's launch in, Rebecca, but could you please tell us what makes you angry?
Oh, I mean, the list is long.
Great.
We're braced.
I think the majority of the things that make me really angry are me or my fault. I'm very intolerant of like forgetting things, getting things wrong, being late. Those make me incredibly angry. And also, I think I find myself anything that I feel like is confining me. So traffic or buses not turning up or forgetting something, anything that makes me feel like I'm not able to get somewhere,
And then I think nearly probably all of the things that are incredibly unfair about being a mum and having a baby are quite and I obviously but I have a 1 year old. And previous to having her, I think I sort of knew that the status quo wasn't great for women, but I didn't know how bad it was. I didn't know that basically the whole of the tube network is unusable with a pram.
God, yes.
And that you will spend so much, like infinite amounts of money on childcare, which will often close or you can't use if they're ill, and you still pay for holidays. And the people running the these places don't even make good money themselves. I think that's my newest bugbear on anger. And I think in terms of small things, probably any time somebody takes a cold Diet Coke out of my fridge and doesn't bring Diet Coke back in, I think it's a hate crime.
How dare they? Well, that is, that's vicious.
It's cruel.
It's so true about the tube though, isn't it? I think what was also really vile in that, in those years for me, was how you try and get one of the people that, you know, were at the gates to maybe give you a hand down the steps or whatever, and they just go, oh, sorry love, health and safety, can't do it. Yes.
I was at Clapham Junction on Wednesday, and I got to the gate, and he said, oh, where are you trying to go? And I said Lewis, and he went, oh, and I thought he was gonna say the train was cancelled, and he went, there's no way you're gonna get the pram up those steps, there's no lift. And I was like, gosh, between us, we think of any way that I might have
well done
steps. And he was like, oh love, I can't help you, just have to hope someone will. And actually, in my experience, no, I've never had to wait more than about 30 seconds for somebody.
Isn't it often a woman?
I like men a lot more since I had a baby.
Oh, that's good. Maybe they've changed.
I think maybe they've changed. Or also, I mean, I do dress fairly provocatively now, so
okay, that's very interesting. What, post having children?
Post being single,
yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Great.
All of my clothes were sort of nice Mormon tents, and now I have to date again. I had to try and find something that showed either my wrists or my ankles at one point, otherwise, you know, not really advertising.
I'd love to bring this closely to your brilliant book that, as Rebecca knows, I ended up giving somebody on the tube because she saw me shed a little tear at the end of it, and we got into a discussion about assertion and rudeness, and I passed it on. I've told Rebecca this already. So Rebecca, there was a sentence in your book, I'm going to read it out actually so I get it right. My desire not to be rude made me the absolute worst version of myself, which I love. So just in your quest to, well, redefine rudeness, I suppose, or to assert anyway, how do you express yourself when it comes to conflict or in anger?
So I think what I spent a lot of time trying to do before was like put my feelings through a sort of Google Translate so that I could come up with like a confusing euphemistic statement which would convey what I wanted to say without actually ever having to say it, in a sort of like Jane Austen comedy of manners format. And I realized that actually it does everyone an enormous disservice, because it's tiring, it's emotional labor trying to work out what someone's actually trying to say.
And also then it leads you to bad habits where, you know, I'd be having an argument with my best friend and I would use full stop at the end of every sentence on WhatsApp
in order to convey my display rather than saying, Stephanie, you not replying yesterday really pissed me off. It's so much easier to be direct, and it's actually less rude to be direct, if you're talking, depending on what kind of rudeness you're talking about. So I've really tried to strip away that sense of like euphemism and sort of, it's almost like double entendre, this pretense you think you're not feeling a certain way, and be really, really being really transparent. And like at the moment I've got a writing partner who I love working with, who's brilliant, but he's so avoidant about committing to plans.
We hate this.
And I used to be quite like, okay, well look, maybe next week we should talk about it. And now I'm just like, I will be at the cafe on Tuesday at 4 p.m. and if you're not there, I'm gonna be furious. So like, if you don't want to fight, and I think there's a levity to it and there's a lightness to it, but the point still stands. It's not trying to like reshape your whole personality and communication to try and avoid provoking events.
And also I noticed in your book that humor really features so strongly, and actually, well, your writing style in that is brilliantly humorous. But that's what I love about it, because you really showed us how to be direct, ask for what we want,
be rude in inverted commas, but not resort to, well, what I have often resorted to in the past, which is a fawning state or a people-pleasing state. Which is why I think that this, your book is particularly good for people like me who have defaulted to that in the past. Fawning, fighting?
Flighting or freezing, right? And I've definitely always gone to fawning in the past.
I get that. And, you know, obviously I wrote the book, but I don't get it right all the time. Mm. And my tendency still, which I have to fight against, is to really feel my anger and then really convey it, but then not have the kind of like chutzpah to back it up. So after, so within half an hour, then be like, I'm so sorry, that was too much, that was too far, even if it wasn't, and I was actually being really reasonable.
And I think there's two levels of confidence you need to be able to kind of use your way. You've got to deliver it, and then you've got to stand by it. And that's
and not kind of backtrack.
Exactly. And backtracking is so tempting, because you get, I think for me, a lot of the studies that I read for the book were about the interplay of women and anger. And it all said that because we don't tend to have like that little steam valve that lets out like a little bit every day, we tend to like wait until the lid blows off and then blow up.
Yeah.
Usually it's like not the thing we're actually upset about. But you've had that catharsis of having the shouting fit, or you've thrown a saucepan across the room, or you've stormed out of the house, whatever you've done. And as soon as you had that catharsis, you then feel guilty and like you've got it wrong. Because I suppose technically you have got it wrong, but you've been pushed to that point. It's generally speaking not your fault. So I think it's about learning to stand by your anger, but part of that is delivering it in a way that doesn't give you that immediate sense of like, okay, it's gone now, because that's a false security. That means you don't deal with the real problem.
Well, I was just going to say about this point that for me is so crucial, which is the identifying the anger in the first place, because I just think women are not great at it. I mean, we're not taught how to do it. We don't have a vocabulary for it. It's not encouraged. We're sort of really swimming against the tide, even just trying to locate it in ourselves as a feeling. So I think that's for me a major part of, you know, the importance of your book, actually.
And also taking up the space, right? It's okay to take up that kind of space. And then, as you quite rightly say, Rebecca, not shrink afterwards and kind of like vacuum clean that space up afterwards and go, sorry, made a mess.
I had a friend who, I can't remember what it was that she did. I think she was having a really, really, really rough time, and she sort of threw a pot of like spaghetti bolognese on the floor, and she'd been provoked like for hours and hours and hours, and it was entirely not her fault. And then of course she spent the whole evening cleaning it up and apologizing.
But coming back to your book, Rebecca, if one does follow a lot of that advice, which is standing your ground in many different situations, be that medical, my gynecologist, for example, the hairdressers, paying for the hen weekend, that was one that really resonated with me. I can really see how it no longer becomes a death by a thousand cuts. If one just shows up for oneself constantly, spaghetti bolognese moment becomes far less likely, right?
Exactly. Yeah, because you're not driven to it, and that it's a muscle, and the more you use it, the better you get at using it, and it's a skill and all of those things. So it's practice, and then you learn to pick your battles, and you're not waiting for breaking point all the time.
It's so true.
Because I think Salima and I definitely are completely obsessed with honesty and friendships, and just being able to firstly identify the feeling, and then secondly just name it in the here and now and not let it build, and also not feel shame for having a feeling and not assume that the other person is going to really badly react to it.
And the funny thing about that is that we've kind of come out through the other side, but it's still the same problem. So now there's this sort of hypertherapized way that some people communicate, where they sort of, there's messages where you say like, are you in a position to receive some information that maybe is distressing to you? And it's a very hyper-American therapized way of talking, which is actually the exact same thing. It's dressed up as more honest, but it's not. And in reality, like my university friendship group, we have a policy that if you're too hungover to turn up for something, we started this obviously when we were young and fun, you could always not come if you've got a hangover, but you can't lie about it. You have to say, I'm hungover, and that's why I'm not.
Nice.
And I think it's setting that culture of honesty and expectation and transparency, and that culture where you say the way that you spoke to me the other day really made me angry, rather than waiting and waiting and waiting and then sending a 9-paragraph WhatsApp.
All being ghosted as well. That's another.
Yeah, exactly. Just kind of leaving somebody hanging because you can't bear them anymore.
Which is easily done, but also, that's fair enough if you can no longer bear somebody, but it shouldn't get to that point. It could, should be a conversation that you kind of gradually have. We can just say, like, what on earth are you doing?
Yeah, and also I think the ghosting thing is complicated, but I think there's a social contract that we all have, and I would expect that if I had a relationship of any description with somebody, that I would be able to afford to send them a couple of lines of a message. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, this is, ghosting is a good example of a phobia of rudeness and a phobia of anger pushing you to bad behavior, because it makes you avoidant rather than doing the grown-up thing and saying, this isn't working for me anymore. You just run away, and that's actually much worse. It makes you almost as bad as the person you're trying to run away from.
And also, as someone who has been ghosted, actually, the, you know, one then feels quite mad because there is no conversation about it. And then, you know, I've definitely exhibited some kind of seemingly unhinged behaviors because I was just kind of so bewildered. But that's because I was looking into space going, what, where are
we? Well, it's sad to be robbed of the opportunity to kind of work on yourself and work on the friendship.
Yeah,
you know, and you can get yourself to a really different place actually when you really sit and do that.
And if they don't want to do that, then that's totally fine too. But then I do think you've been robbed of the opportunity to know what, like, you know, to at least take some information into it. And also, I don't know, there's just something horrible about having information withheld from you. I hate it. One of my best friends dumped me many, many years ago, and I think she probably had a point. Like, actually, I think I was the problem. But it took years, and I would, like, I still check her Twitter every now and again. I've never.
What? And that was just a ghosted. She walked. You never. Why
they were supposed to be I sort of know why. I was slacking her off to another friend, and somebody videoed it and sent it to her, so like that I understand why. My criticisms were fair, but I shouldn't have been saying about them about her behind her back. I was also, in my defense, I was like 23 at the time.
Who the hell sent her that
I know, and weirdly she stayed friends with the person who did the video sending, who I think arguably is the bigger villain.
But is that a kind of flying monkey narcissist type thing?
Yes, very much so. But she just blocked me on all platforms, and we never talked about it. And I think also I would really like to have apologised, like properly apologised in person. If you're listening, I'm sorry.
Yeah. But also I often think with relationships, be they, partnerships, lovers, friendships, whatever, if you had love for one another at any point, then surely there has to be some kind of recognition. There is a kind of straightforward, rude, in-your-face conversation to be had, right? Where we all assert ourselves and say how we feel, and then we have to hug and skip
that
into the meadows.
The time and the investment you've put into that relationship.
Exactly.
Surely it deserves that, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think in all breakups, friendship, platonic or otherwise, it's exactly that. It's saying, I know I hate you right now, but there was a time where I did love you, and I'm going to act like that version of myself, not the version of myself that I feel like today, because I know that the version of me who was obsessed with you and wanted to be around you all the time would want me to behave this way.
Yes,
this is it. It's funny actually, that
going back to when you said that you just never heard properly back from the former best friend, we've said, haven't we, about how horrible it is to just not know, not be told, to not hear. It's a really, really uncomfortable state for a human, I think. Like, you know, we just want the news, essentially, you know, even if it's hard to take, we'd rather know.
Yeah. And I think all of my sort of worst issue with anxiety have all been based around not knowing, not understanding, not feeling like I had all the pieces of the jigsaw,
and filling in the gaps in kind of crazy ways yourself.
And your brain will always find the meanest possible explanation.
Of course it will.
And I think that it's amazing how much we'll punish each other to try and avoid making each other angry.
Right. Ooh. Oh, that's a very good point.
That's powerful. Deep.
We'll avoid that, but also to avoid thinking of ourselves as angry people as well, right? Yeah, not even for the other person. I think it can be for ourselves, because we as women perhaps might sometimes like to think of ourselves as calm and considered and compassionate. So we will not be angry and have an uncomfortable conversation where you might make me inflamed or furious or say something I might regret. I will just
smile sweetly and keep walking.
Because we can't sit with that
part of ourselves, that angry part of ourselves.
Because it's messy, isn't it? And ugly.
Yeah, and a lot of the research I did was about why women are more gossipy and more likely to talk behind each other's backs, and why that sort of semi-sexist stereotype is true. And the research also said basically because women, particularly teenage girls, are not encouraged to have any kind of physical outlets, broadly speaking, generally, but also, you know, they don't fight, they don't play contact sports, they tend to look for it mentally and emotionally.
Indirect aggression.
Exactly. Yeah. And then it sets a pattern for the rest of your life, because, you know, arguably we're just as hormonal as boys, just in a slightly different way. And we're in the same pressure cooker of emotions. Mm-hmm. We need outlets for our physical strength and frustration. And we probably do need to be able to fight a little bit with each other, because that's sort of...
Yes.
But in reality, what happens is, yeah, you just say, oh my God, did you see that she thought she was somebody who could wear denim shorts? That is not what her thoughts are. That kind of stuff is
brutal.
The recognition that we are not all Mary Poppins or full of sugar and spice, that we are complicated, contradictory creatures who can act appallingly. And then you can say, Salima, you've acted appallingly and you've been really awful.
Or also often you're living in the graveyard of other problems. So your behavior on Tuesday is actually about something that happened in November, and then the thing that happened in November is actually about something that happened in sixth form, and you never properly resolve any of these things because you never really get angry and clear the air.
Yes, it just aggregates up, builds and builds.
You're just, layering on layering.
Rebecca, can you tell us about your angriest moment? Is that possible?
I've had too many of them.
Or was there a phase in your life, you know?
Well, I think I am quite an angry person. I feel things very deeply and very strongly. I think the other day I had one where I and it's fairly illogical, but I was waiting at the bus stop, and I find parenting a challenge. I adore my daughter, but I'm not one of life's like natural give me 9 babies and I want to move to a cottage kind of people. And I needed to be somewhere, and the bus arrived and there were already 2 prams on the bus, and the bus driver just like shook his head and drove off. And I was just like so earth-shatteringly furious with the universe that the world exists where women literally cannot take transport because of having a baby. And there was just something like about and it wasn't his fault, obviously, and it's a horrible job and I shouldn't be angry with him, but I was just like, from the bottom of my heart, fuck you. Like, this is, I just need you to get on your bus. And I think I have had those sort of abject moments, but what I'm really gratified by, and it's complete luck, is that I've had friends who've had postpartum anger issues where they found it really hard not to be angry with their baby. And I've just through luck, not through anything I've done. It's funny that the one person I never get angry with is my daughter, and I've never felt angry with her ever. I feel angry with myself a lot of the time for getting things wrong, but I don't ever feel angry with her. And I think that's a real gift, because I know a lot of women really struggle with it, and there's so much stigma around postpartum anger.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Even with that example, you can see how the capacity for it to be displaced onto the baby, like how essentially it's to do with the universe, it's to do with shit treatment and basically how hard it is to be a mom in this world. It's really easy to see how it could be located in the baby.
And I completely understand it. And I think I've got quite a lot of friends whose mums lost their careers through having children and who've never been able to totally untangle those two things, and still a little bit angry with their daughters for,
of course,
but also, you know, as we were talking before we started recording about, you know, the shifts between, you know, pre-children and children, it's so vital that we all speak as openly as we possibly can once we've had children. Or it doesn't have to be to many people, but even just to like your sister or your cousin or your best friend who's having a baby, and just to say
if you're going to be up all night with your baby, you might not be able to concentrate on a meeting in the morning like you thought you were going to. It's not awful to feel angry that you can't concentrate. Yeah. It's not awful to feel these things.
It's the honesty.
It's finding those people around
vital.
You.
And I've always, because I, you know, I went back to work after 6 weeks, and I, you know, was back being a columnist for a broadsheet within 8 weeks. I was on television 7 weeks after she was born. But I formula fed. I had a planned section. I had a night nanny 2 nights a week. Mm-hmm. And because I'm a single parent, I think people sometimes look at how I manage things, and it looks like I've really got my shit together. But the reality is, I have incredibly supportive parents and siblings, and all of that infrastructure, and have had childcare at least since she was 6 weeks old. That's why I can do those things.
Right.
And it's been tempting, I'm not going to lie, to have pretended that she was an amazing sleeper because I was just so good at breastfeeding, not because she was mainlining the Aptamil. Like, it would have been tempting to have clawed back some dignity and been like, yeah, she just always sleeps 14 hours and, like, you know, she's just really happy playing on the floor.
But look, if you'd done that,
you'd have located something in those women, your own sense of inferiority or something back in them. And so you broke that, and for that I think we should be grateful. Yeah, on behalf of womankind, thank you for doing that.
Yeah, seriously,
Rebecca, thank you so much for coming to talk to us. We really appreciate it. It's been brilliant, actually.
Magical.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
Really great fun.
So it was really refreshing talking to Rebecca and hearing about everything that she obviously spent so long with in terms of the research for that book and in terms of thinking in her own life about what she needed to change. I think particularly this point about telling friends that you're angry with them or that you don't like something they've done, that you want to try to do things differently in the relationship. This is all a brand new landscape, I'd say, for most women.
And the stuff of nightmare. I mean, okay, it used to be the stuff of nightmares for me, but now I am increasingly strict about who my friends actually are, or my close pals.
I think I would say all of
my close pals I can do that with now.
I would agree. I think for both of us, our circles have shrunk to such a tiny, safe size.
Yeah.
That basically includes each other.
Yes.
And a sort of horde of trusted confidants.
Yeah. And also, look, I'm a lot more hierarchical about friendships in that way. Mm. And I think all my friends will appreciate this because they possibly didn't want me in their inner circle either. Mm. I was just kind of barging my way in. So I am very clear now as to who these few are.
I said, don't ever leave me, I'll die.
Don't ever leave.
But, you know, no pressure.
That is the scary thing about it, is because you become very, very dependent, obviously, on the chosen
chosen one. But look, I think it becomes...
You just get a lot more clarity, don't you? Because I know I can go to you, for example, I really don't agree. I don't like that. You were really weird then. Why did you do that? Am I being an idiot? Should I do this? Was I awful to you last week? And I know you'll go,
yeah, you were a real dick. What were you doing? And I feel safe enough to let you tell me I'm a dick as well.
Well, also, I think we've been able to do that so much now that it's quite exciting, because I always think, oh, where is it going to lead us to? Because we know that we get to much more interesting, creative places.
Yes, if you say, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh my God, yeah, what was I doing? Good point. Thank you. Okay. I'll try again.
Yeah.
So it saves so much time.
Oh God, yeah.
That's the main thing. It's just saves so much.
And it's built so much time. You know, you sort of save in one sense, but also you allow yourselves this whole new universe that can be filled and filled and filled with really productive, potential stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, look, the quicker you find out you're not doing something well, or you've misunderstood something, or you've upset somebody, the quicker you can rectify. It's the whole, you know, my thoughts on this, the whole ghosting, mysterious, you know, pass ag kind of behaviours, you know, that I have sent me mad in the past.
Totally. I've just thought, but just tell me.
Yeah.
Am I off, you know, have I behaved terribly? Okay, then tell me.
So it is, in a way, in terms of like recommending to other people that this happens for them, choosing those people that they feel so comfortable with, maybe
it's
because
about safety.
Yeah. And I suppose testing out, you know, can this friendship take it? And you really, I suppose you don't know until you try.
Yeah, and you just have to keep trying. You have to keep leaping and keep being brave. And then believe what you see, isn't it? That's that old adage. You see it, you feel that they can't, or they just don't want to with you, which, look, is fair enough. You're not for everybody. I'm not for everybody. And the sooner we know that, the better.
That's right. And that's your evidence then. These are your people or these are not your people.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, no hard feelings, right? No hard feelings. We're not for one another. That's okay.
Yeah, right. And I guess if there are lingering issues with that, then that's, you take that somewhere. You go and figure that out. Like, to keep throwing it back on that person. I hate them. They let me down, or they're responsible for something bad for me. That's not really useful to anyone.
It's not really them. It's not really them either.
Mm. Indeed. Onwards and upwards.
Indeed.
See you next time.
See you next time.
Thank you for listening and sharing in our anger.
And remember, you're not mad to feel mad.
Please like and subscribe. It helps other people find the podcast.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.